Sometime last year, I preached a very unbalanced sermon, or so I was informed by a sermon reviewer who spoke to me after the service. Now, normally if someone criticises your preaching efforts, you can always retain some semblance of pride by wondering if the critic really could do any better than you could, you know. Of course, one never wonders this out loud with the person, the critic, present. However, on this occasion that I was critiqued as having delivered this unbalanced or maybe even wobbly sermon, I was compelled to the view that this particular critic probably should be heard out. The critic was the venerable and apparently immortal Vic Maddock. Now, I suspect Vic has preached more fine sermons than I've had hot coffees, and I'll bet every one of them is perfectly constructed, impeccably logical, disarmingly clear and simple, and delivered with every consonant and vowel perspicuously enunciated. Vic's sermons always strike me as a kind of wide gateway with heavily oiled hinges through which the Holy Spirit can reveal the presence of God to everybody in the congregation. So if Vic Maddock is telling me that my sermon was unbalanced, I guess I better listen. How do you mean unbalanced? I asked, steering Vic away from the narthex lest anyone should overhear us. Well, Vic explained, for a start, I think you only had 2 points. And I had to agree with his arithmetic. And you spent 15 minutes on the first one and only 4 minutes on the second one. You should try to make 3 points, and you should try to give them equal weight. I was tempted to defend my wobbly method by saying I actually knew a lot more about the first point than the second one, which is why I spent more time on it. But somehow I felt that would probably make matters worse. Well, I would like to say that I have taken Vic's admonishments to heart, but that would not be true. I remain a kind of stream of consciousness preacher, more in the tradition of Virginia Woolf than the architectural logic and clarity of a C.S. Lewis. According to the preacher's textbook, I understand there is one, never read it, but I understand there is one, proper preachers sit down with a 3-point template. Proper preachers tell us what they're going to tell us, then they tell us, and then they told us what they told us. Proper preachers have 2 or 3 illustrations to help you understand each of their 3 points. And they get it all done in 20 minutes flat. But see, I don't have the skill to engineer a sermon like that. I'm afraid I just let the ideas rattle around in my head for a few weeks. I ruminate. That's what it means to have ideas rattle around in your head. In fact, I'm a very great ruminator. No, actually, great's not the right adjective. Because this rumination, this thinking about the topic endlessly, is really just me putting off that horrible moment. That moment when I sit down to a blank page in Microsoft Word and I write, Sermon for St. Paul's. And I move the mouse to the icon and click Heading 1. And then I have to start. So while I'm waiting for that horrible moment, I keep thinking about the sermon and I get great ideas, or so they seem, and then I forget them. And finally it gets to be Friday or Saturday and I must start, so I say a little panicked prayer to God and I turn the computer on and I begin. And I write. And I make my first point and I tell my first story and then I think of something else to say, so I write that too. And then I get a moment of inspiration that is clearly divine, so I thank God for that and I write that in. And then I think I've said enough about that point, so I write the next one. And then Judy calls out if I'd like a cup of coffee and I think of including her in my sermon. But I resist the temptation. Until now, anyway. And I enjoy my coffee and God says, he'll do better with coffee in him, and off I go again. And after some hours of this torture, I come to the end and I have a sermon. An unbalanced 2-point sermon. But not today. No, today, folks, I have 3 points. And I... I wish to celebrate this feat of God's amazing grace by telling you what they are before I tell you what they are. I wish to make 3 points. First point, Jesus seems to have spent most of his ministry among the unchurched. Maybe we should too. Second point, one of the reasons we Christians have difficulty in relating to the unchurched is because we have been too thoroughly churched. Third point, the role of the Christian in relation to the unchurched is to be the presence of God. These are my 3 points. If you want to put your iPods back in your ears, you can go ahead now because you've heard it all. Okay, here's what these 3 points mean. First point, Jesus seems to have spent most of his ministry among the unchurched. Maybe we should too. This story we heard this morning about the calling of Levi or Matthew. You know, I have in mind that maybe after Luke had written this, he bumped into Matthew. They would have been fairly elderly by this stage. And Matthew said, you know, you got my name wrong. Because he's called him Levi, right, in the story this morning. You were the only one listening, Peter. Okay. And Luke's gone, oh, really? You know, I just talked to Mark, and he's a bit Alzheimer's these days, so maybe he got it wrong. Why does Matthew have two names? You're wondering this. Most people seem to wonder this, and they spend a lot of time thinking up hypotheses. The simple truth is we don't know the answer to this. Some people suggest that, you know, one name is a Greek name and the other name is a Hebrew name, but this is not true. Matthew is a perfectly good name in either language. It's simpler to point out, I reckon, that some people just have two names. I mean, some people are called Ravindram and Samuel. You know? And my dad was christened John, and everybody called him Jack. Yeah, there you go. And my mum christened me Philip, but for the rest of her life she called me Buffhead. The important point of this story is that when Jesus calls Matthew Levi to be one of his 12, one of his closest associates, he's calling someone who is clearly unchurched. Not just somebody who was a bit irregular in church. Matthew Levi never went to church. In fact, he was never allowed in. Who do we consider are the scum of society today? Drug dealers or terrorists who kill innocent people, or maybe vandals who write graffiti on our fences? Well, in Palestine, in the time when Jesus lived, if you asked that question of people, who is the scum of society, the common answer would have been tax collectors and sinners. This very phrase that we heard in today's reading. And why were tax collectors the scum of society? Well, I expect a lot of you know this already, but let me remind you. First, it was because they collected taxes, which tends to make you a bit unpopular. But second, it was for whom they collected the taxes that made them much more unpopular. They collected for the Romans, and the Romans, of course, were the invaders. They were the enemy. They were the conquerors of the country. And tax collectors worked for the enemy. And associating with a tax collector in those days would have been rather like associating with a Nazi collaborator in the Second World War. Thirdly, they were thieves. The Romans didn't care how much tax the tax collectors collected, as long as they collected the amount the Romans wanted them to collect. But there was no limit on how much they could collect. If the Romans wanted them to collect 5 shekels, they could charge 10 or 100, and all the difference between the 5 and the 100 went in their own pockets. It was a form of institutionalized extortion, and the religious authorities declared tax collectors as unclean. That meant they were not permitted to enter the synagogue or the temple. They were pretty much as unchurched as a person could be. And what a signal Jesus sends. He asks this most unchurched of the unchurched to come into his inner circle as a permanent member. And worse, Jesus then goes with Matthew Levi to his house, a house no doubt paid for by the money robbed from the Palestinians, and he has a big dinner, a banquet. And who's at the dinner? The friends of Matthew Levi. And who are they? Tax collectors. The message might be not too clear to us today, but it was like an earthquake to the religious people of the time. This was all wrong. Jesus was spending all this time with the unchurched. Now, when I read the gospel accounts of Jesus' ministry, that's what I see. Hardly any time spent in a church, and lots of time spent with the unchurched. Maybe it's something we should notice. Which brings me neatly to my second point. My second point of 3 points, by the way. Second point, one of the reasons we Christians have difficulty in relating to the unchurched is because we have been too thoroughly churched. Now, I think I've invented a new word here. It seems to me, though, that if a person who does not go to church can be described as unchurched, then a person who does go to church can be described as churched. Okay? Too many of us, I reckon, in the church have been too thoroughly churched. We've grown up in the church. Our friends are in the church. Maybe we even went to church schools. We married people within the church. We socialise with people in the church. We express our gifts in the church. And not just in the church, but very often in a single church, in a single place for nearly all of our lives. Now, I have to say for most of us, this is a very satisfying experience. We're comfortable at home and we feel at home among churched people. God's good to us here in the church. We want others to experience the joy of the community, or to use a word that you never hear outside of the church, the fellowship. I think I'll go off with my work colleagues for a cup of coffee and some fellowship. I don't think that will work outside of the church. Well, because we like it so much here in the church, we want to invite others in. Others should experience this as well. And we see evangelism mostly as inviting people into the church, inviting the unchurched into the church. So what we do is we try to copy the world, make the church look more attractive to the unchurched. We provide community services so that the unchurched will come into the church and experience the joy of our fellowship. There's only one thing wrong with this strategy, or maybe two things, because it doesn't seem to work very well. But the most obvious thing that's wrong with this strategy is that it's not what Jesus would do. If we look to Jesus as our model for our ministry, we note that while he did go to church, or at least to the equivalent in his time, he did not see it as a place for evangelism. Instead of inviting people in, he took his message out. Jesus went where the people were. He walked right up to the office of the tax collector and he said, "Follow me." And they got up and followed him. And where did they follow him to? Back to the church? No. They followed him to dinner in this case. They followed him to a dinner with the bad people. Dinner with the down and outs. Dinner with the sinners. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there's something bad about being in the four walls of the church building. Jesus did go to church. I'm not saying we should not be a joyous and caring community. I'm sure that's God-honoured. I'm not saying we should not socialise together. We are social people. God made us that way. He intends us to socialise together. But I am saying that these are not the reasons that the church is here. It does not exist to create these things. These things are a byproduct of its real reason for existence. The church may feel like a club, but that's not why the church exists. And if the reason we come is only to enjoy the club, only to enjoy the fellowship, then we're making the church into nothing more than a social club. And there are plenty of them outside the church. And that brings me to my third point of 3 points. Third point, the role of the Christian in relation to the unchurched is to be the presence of God. If the church does not exist just to be a club of the churched people, why does it exist? What is it that the church can provide that nothing else can? The only thing the church can provide that no one else can is a life-changing, practical encounter and an ongoing relationship with the living God and with people transformed by a similar experience. So our role is to be the presence of God in the world. One commentator has written, "This doesn't mean inviting Jesus into your heart. It does mean feeling a sense of God's presence and feeling that one has encountered God within the church." Have you encountered God here today? Can we say with Jacob, surely the Lord is in this place? If the answer is no, then this worship service has failed you. And those of us who construct these weekly events are failing in our responsibilities, because our role is to allow God's presence to be felt. Most places we look in Australia today, we see a dying church. There are fewer and fewer people going to church. And some churches, on the other hand, are growing. And you wonder sometimes whether they're onto something. Well, it's beyond my capability altogether to do an analysis of church growth in Australia, and it's certainly beyond the bounds of this morning. But I do think that one of the factors is that churches that give people some sense of the presence of God are onto something. I've certainly experienced God's presence here at St Paul's, and I've also experienced it elsewhere. I've experienced it in charismatic worship services, and I've had similar, what I would say are divine encounters in other places, during the wonderful chanting in the Romanian Orthodox Church in Bucharest, a quite otherworldly experience. And I remember once prayerfully and quietly taking Holy Communion with the priest and the one other parishioner in the English-speaking Anglican Church in Copenhagen. The three of us encountered God together. And I remember having a similar experience of the divine, listening to a splendid young American organist playing Bach in the Augustinian Church in Vienna. And it is worth commenting that that was during a recital, not during an organised worship service, yet God was present. Now, there was something otherworldly about these experiences, and of course any encounter with God must be otherworldly. If our worship services are simply attempts to outproduce modern television or outproduce modern films, well, what's the point? The church is never going to effectively compete with what the world has to offer. Maybe 40 years ago it may have been possible to compete effectively with the world. I know in my youth we tried really hard. We thought that's what we should do. Following the Sunbury Rock Festival down here, a group of Christian young people in Queensland that Judy and I were part of put together a similar show on the Gold Coast, an all-day rock festival that was televised. We had a great time. I'm not sure anyone encountered God there. But in the 21st century, there's no chance. No chance that we can compete with the world. Instead, we need to understand the main reason we are here. Not to provide a Sunday morning club for the insiders, but to create an environment that opens us up to God's presence. Not to run playgroups so that people are introduced to our community, but so that they may have a personal encounter with God. Not to have social events so that we can enjoy each other's company, but so that God may be present in ways we can each feel in the depths of our being. Not so that we can have Thursday night dinners so hungry people will be fed, but to mediate the Holy Spirit in such a way that people have an encounter with the living God. But more than that, we need to unchurch ourselves. We need to get out of the church and be the presence of God among the unchurched. We need to go to the office of the tax collector and be the presence of God. More than we need Christian songs, we need Christians whose songs are on the commercial radio playlists. More than we need Christian magazines, we need Christians who will live and work and write in the mainstream television and news. More than Christians in the church on Sunday, we need them out among the unchurched, at the footy, in the shopping centres, in business, in the life of the unchurched. I remember soon after we started attending here at St Paul's, I was introduced to an intense looking fellow who was a primary school principal. I discovered his name was Brian Allen and that he was then the principal of the Great Ryrie Primary School, which, since I didn't know where it was or anything about it, I thought sounded particularly fabulous. The Great Ryrie Primary School. Well, I was having a conversation with him, and I was really just trying to keep my end of the conversation up, and I happened to ask, have you ever thought of being a principal in a Christian school? Well, Brian replied with all the gentleness of a road grader. He said, why would I want to do that? And I quickly discovered that Brian thought Christians were more use in the state school system than they were if hived off into private education. See, our calling for Brian is to the unchurched. Now, if I were Ken Holt, I would now be able to give you 10 helpful hints on how to be the presence of God among the unchurched. But as I am not Vic Maddock, nor am I Ken Holt. So the best I can do is to encourage us to apply the maxim, what would Jesus do in every circumstance? Because the answer to that question is often the presence, the making of the presence of God. The more we try to emulate Jesus in the world, the more we become the channel for the Holy Spirit to encounter the unchurched. So I am now able to complete my address by reminding you of my 3 points. First point, Jesus seems to have spent most of his ministry among the unchurched. Maybe we should too. Second point, one of the reasons we Christians have difficulty in relating to the unchurched is because we have been too thoroughly churched. Third point, the role of the Christian in relation to the unchurched is to be the presence of God. I'm so glad Vic is not here today.